Simon, the last album, The Bone Carver, has been released in 22.
Yeah.
And the album before that, Born Into the Waves, in 2016. That's 6 years before. Now the new album, Mother of Pearl Moon, comes after, I think, 1.5, maybe 2 years. That's very fast, in a way.
Yes.
Can you tell us about the process of composing and recording?
Yeah, well, first of all, of course, there was the COVID epidemic, which put back the release of the Bone Carver, because everything was, of course, delayed and messed up by that. But the one positive thing, or one of the positive things to come out of that whole episode of 2020 and to 2022, I suppose, was that it did create a different environment for working, different situation. One of the things that came out of it was that Justin, my brother, was able to discipline himself into waking up before dawn and going down into his garden shed every morning for a period of in 2020, telling himself that he needed, well, that each day he would make one improvised guitar piece and record it quite spontaneously. He was drawing from experiences that we'd had when we were on stage with a project of ours called The Brothers of the Trees, which is Justin and I, and often Colin, our multi-instrumentalist, who was joining us, where we were playing reworkings, the three of us were playing reworkings of existing and also the Trees pieces, joined up by sections of semi-improvised instrumental pieces. Now, it sounds a bit complicated, but while Justin was playing those guitar parts, which were quite often like drones that would sort of wander off into a certain direction, he got to places where, I think, speaking to him afterwards about it, he said that he could see where they could have developed as improvisations. Mm-hmm. But he didn't go. He stepped back because we're not really used to that improvised work. He stepped back from it and, I guess, in a way, played safe. But what he did when he was waking up early in the mornings was to sort of put himself back in the frame of mind that he was in during those performances and actually taking the path that he could have taken. So actually really experimenting and making improvisations. Anyway, after he'd made a number of these improvisations, he sent them to me, and we had the idea of releasing a Brothers of the Trees album based on these recordings. So I started to improvise vocals, just pressing the record button and reacting to his improvisations. And I was getting really pretty good results on a good percentage of them. After that, we listened to them and thought, yes, this is great, going in the right direction. We won't include any of the old reworked and also the Trees pieces. Let's see if we can write a whole album based on these improvised ideas in guitar. So we carried on working, and after a while, Justin brought in Colin, who experimented with clarinet, bass clarinet, and the piano, which he has in his house in London. And he got some really good results as well. And so this was coming together quite quickly. The last thing we did, because Justin was also writing some bass parts afterwards on a baritone guitar. Mm-hmm. So we had the bass end covered, so to speak. And then quite late on, we thought, well, maybe some percussion would be good. It seems wrong to, like, deliberately exclude a percussionist, who would be Paul, of course, the Trees drummer. So he passed some of the ideas to him and gave him a kind of the idea that, being as the pieces were sounded quite orchestral anyway, to take more of a of an orchestral approach, if you like using timpanis and bass drums, and not thinking of like using the drum kit in the rock sense as a whole drum kit. So he added some percussion and some drum parts, and they worked well. And so that took it right up to the point of like, well, is this Brothers of the Trees or is this And Also the Trees? And we couldn't decide. There were a lot of things that we were wondering, weighing up, is it the one or the other? In the end, when it came back from being mastered, I listened to it and I thought, well, how can this not be And Also the Trees? And then we talked about it and, yes, decided it has to be an And Also the Trees album in the end.
Okay. You said that Paul started an orchestral approach, not the rock kit. That's what I thought when I heard the album, because there are a lot of songs which have not the rock drums or no drums or this orchestral drums that supported, I think, this kind of wave-like structures of the music. The guitars are coming and going slow and fast, and you had some songs in the past without any drums at all.
Yeah.
I think not on every album, but on the most.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a very interesting approach, I think.
We talked about that with our sound engineer as well, Matthew Devenish, who's actually a drummer as well. And we said it could be interesting to approach the songs by not sitting at a drum kit, taking maybe just the floor tom, seeing how it would work without the temptation of kick drums and hi-hats. So you just have the floor tom to work with, and that worked quite well.
You took a different approach with the singing and the lyrics as well, I think, when you started record right from the beginning. Was that difficult?
No, it's what I generally do anyway. I just react to the music. I don't really have a formula or a way of working. It's purely instinctive. I just go with what comes and hope that what comes is interesting or usable. And sometimes I go months and none of it is any good. And sometimes it comes by surprise. It's kind of annoying because it means you never know what's going to happen. But on the other hand, it can be quite exciting. I don't know. Maybe this afternoon I could go and do something marvelous, in my opinion. And or I might have to wait another 6 months before I do anything that's even reasonable. Mm-hmm. From that point of view, did I take a different approach? I think psychologically with the whole album, we were, being as we were thinking that it was going to be Brothers of the Trees, we weren't thinking about it following on from the last And Also the Trees album. So in a way, we were a little bit freer to do what we wanted to do without realizing that we had these restrictions. Because, of course, with the And Also the Trees album, we wanted it to be a natural development from the previous one. Mm-hmm. We also wanted it to be better than the previous one, because we think that if we're not getting better, then there's no point in continuing, really. We put that pressure on ourselves, I suppose. And with this album, we didn't have that pressure. It was like an experimental album. So it was a bit freer.
There are some instrumental songs on the album again. No Mountains, No Horizon and Ypsilon. Will Ypsilon be part of the live set? 10-minute version extended?
I doubt it. I doubt it. I would be fine about it. Actually, I wanted the album to be half instrumental and half with vocal. In the end, it didn't work out that way because I kept having good vocal ideas for the pieces. But I was certainly open to more instrumentation, not just because I'm lazy and it doesn't involve me, but just because I liked the idea of making the vocal less present on all the pieces. But it came how it came.
You said in our last interview that the instrumental songs are usually songs to which you don't get a kind of lyrical connection in a way. That's interesting because I think there are a lot of Trees songs, maybe most of them, that do not really think about the singer. From my feeling, there are not often parts which are obviously parts for the singer. The normal way is, okay, play this riff, three chords, 10 times, that's your part. But the Trees songs work in a kind of instrumental way. You said on the website history, you talk about the first album, the debut album, and that the song Shrine was an instrumental piece, but you put on the vocals then. So how do you get into the songs to create this connection?
I guess this album was different in the respect that from the start we wanted, particularly I wanted, there to be a lot of instrumental pieces. Well, the instrumentals, sometimes very early on we would decide, okay, let's leave this to be instrumental. I won't try to get any vocal. Other times I think, well, I might as well try. There's no harm. It doesn't cost anything for me to press the record button and see what happens. Mm. Whereas in the past, going back in time, yeah, there were instances where I was trying again and again for days to try and get a vocal part, couldn't, and the song would then turn into an instrumental. It would need some rewriting, of course, instrumentally. Once they know that there's not going to be a vocal there, it means that the arrangement can be changed and other sounds can be brought in. But with this album, it was... I didn't really attempt to get vocal parts. And going back to what you were saying, our way of writing, it's true, the vocal lines very rarely carry the melody. That is usually Justin's guitar parts carry the melody and the vocal does something else. It works around the guitar melody, which is good. It's just the way things work. I wouldn't say it's deliberate. We don't have that understanding. It's just the way things work. Mm. Justin is very good at creating melodies. I'm not. So it's kind of useful that he covers that area, the melodic side of it, and I cover the lyrical and the vocal side of the songs.
And how do you work on the lyrics? Are you putting together lines, verses over longer time to a complete lyric, or do you work concentrated on one piece and after that the next one?
These years, I should say, I tend to switch from one piece to another very quickly. Otherwise, in the past, going back to albums like Farewell to the Shade and Green is the Sea, I could get completely swallowed up by pieces of music and I would be saying to myself, okay, I'll just give this song another week before I quit. And then a week would pass and I wouldn't have progressed. And I'll say, okay, I'm so close. I'll give it another week and you know, it can go on forever. These days I have a different system where I don't allow myself to do that. I switch very quickly from one piece to another.
The sea is back in the lyrics. Sea, water, shore, beach, tide, waves, a whaler wrecked on the sand. In what kind of way is the sea an important element within the Trees' music and aesthetic, also in the cover or the titles of the albums?
I'm not sure. Maybe because we're living on an island.
You have been mentioned recently in a new book about folk horror, The Routledge Companion of Folk Horror, and it deals with different kinds of British horror elements like landscapes, films and music. Can you tell us in which connection your lyrics are mentioned in the book?
They're mentioned in covered in quite an interesting way. I was cautious when Julianne got in touch with us and said she wanted to write about us concerning folk horror, because I thought, well, I don't understand the horror connection, really, because I was being simplistic and thinking of, like, Hammer horror and vampires and the likes. So I was a bit cautious and thought, okay, but fine, fair enough. And we talked about a few things. And then when I read what she'd written, I understood. She is covering, for example, I would call it like a dark undercurrent that runs beneath rural life and through folk stories. She's referencing, for example, the dress hanging in the song The Pear Tree. It's not obviously macabre. It's quite dark, I suppose, if you look at it in a certain way. She's referencing the figure that's walking through the corn in the flatlands. Again, it's not obviously horror, but there is something slightly unsettling about it. And this is what she's really focusing on there. It's more subtle than I thought it would be, and I think it's really well written and well observed.
Okay, I think undercurrent is a good word I was thinking about. There are songs like Legend of Marklow or Count Jeffrey, which may have a kind of horror or dark horror elements, creepy, monstrous in a way, but many of your lyrics are settled in this undercurrent, maybe a world in between realities, like Jack or Riverman on the new album is a song like that, where the Riverman is a person, but we don't know who he is. So what is this person?
Yes.
A kind of shade.
At the end of that, I wanted to make it clear that he wasn't a bad guy.
What is your personal connection to, if we say horror or maybe this unreal component? Do we have the special influences?
I don't know. Having been brought up in the countryside, and really having to be within it, working on the land and sitting at my window for years, looking out at the countryside changing, I suppose I picked up on the elements of the past. As kids, we were told, when we first moved to the countryside, we were told the sort of spooky stories and ghost stories about the area, and that lived with me for a long time. And I suppose, yeah, it's just an area of interest. It needs to... I don't know what it needs to do. It interests me, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would like to come back to the album again, The Mother of the Pearl Moon. How did you come up with the idea of the album cover? It's a sunflower in black and white.
This is a photograph I took a long time ago, just randomly in the house. And as a photographer, as well as a musician, I've got a lot of photographs, of course, and I look through them and I send stuff to Justin and as ideas for use. He saw it and thought he loved that picture. I was quite surprised, but I like it as well. And and it works with the title for reasons that are not exactly understandable, but I think that's always the best way for our covers. It needs to be not too obvious, mm-hmm. but for some reason that you don't quite understand, it works.
And the album is called after, or named after a song from the album, Mother of Pearl Moon. Who is this Mother of Pearl Moon?
Mother of Pearl, it's talking about, Justin said this as well, it could be understood in two ways, and I'd never thought of it that way. It isn't about a person. It isn't mm-hmm. about the mother of somebody called Pearl Moon. I guess you know that. Mother of Pearl is a semi-precious stone.
Ah, okay.
So it's the moon looks like Mother of Pearl. That's the reference there.
Okay. What is the song about? Can you tell us a bit?
No, not really. It's just a journey to a place. I don't know how I got there. I got there through the music. And, well, it's a lyric, and it came from another idea a lot earlier, but that's not really interesting to talk about, which was called Japanese Soldier, a song that never, that didn't develop. Mm-hmm. This can happen with bands and with An Oath to the Trees. You have ideas that don't work and lyrical ideas that you work on and they never go anywhere, but then they stay in your mind and come back in a different form later on. And it was just my reaction to the music. And it's like a series of images.
So maybe this is another example for this undercurrent thing we talked about. We have a situation, but really don't know where it has settled.
Yeah.
In the end.
Yeah, I think so.
I have another song I would like to talk about. It's a Waldrada, a song with a concrete name of a city in this case. Can you tell us something about the city or its influences? Where does it come from?
The name Valderrada comes from a novel written by Italo Calvino, the Italian writer. I came across his book in a second-hand shop in London and just bought it because I liked the title. I'm a big reader. I get a lot of my inspiration from reading books, not directly usually anymore, but just like filling my well up with ideas. And when that piece of music was playing and I pressed the record button, probably didn't come immediately, but I started singing Valderrada because it was in my head. And then I thought, where did that come from? And then I thought, ah, yes, it's the book, Invisible Cities. So the stories in the book are about Marco Polo telling Kublai Khan about all the cities that he's visited. And actually, he tells him about a different place every day. Or this is what Kublai Khan thinks he's being told. When in fact, what he's doing, Marco Polo is just telling him about Venice every time, but from a different angle. And he's making up the names of cities, which is a very nice idea. I like this book. I didn't want to base it very, you know, absolutely on the Valderrada in Calvino's book, but this is where the idea came from. I added my own ideas to it, of course. I've built on his city, which he invented anyway. So I added the Minoans, and in fact, I added most of it. There's just a couple of things that came from his description of Valderrada that I've kept, but the rest of it was my imagination. So yeah, it's a nice idea. Maybe one day someone will build on my Valderrada and add more to it. That could be good.
I think it's interesting to know where the influences come from, because on your another example is on your homepage, you're writing this history of the trees.
Yeah.
And there you told about the Secret Sea, which is one of my top three favorites in music and in the different versions and the lyrics. And you told that the line swimming in the secret sea was from a newspaper, and it was about a baby in the womb.
Exactly.
That's very interesting, because the sleep is a topic, but I didn't find out. Yeah, what is it? What's the sleep cocoon? Now I know.
Yeah, I often wonder if I'm giving too much away with these stories, but I think I'm getting it just about right at the moment.
I have a question about another favorite song of mine, which is the Headless Clay Woman from the Virus Meadow album.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what this song is about, or where the lyrics come from?
I can. Mm-hmm. It's again, it's a question about whether I'm giving away too much.
Yes.
But if you look at the back cover of the reissue of Virus Meadow, I don't know if you've got it, but or if you've seen it, there is a photograph of a clay figurine. It is the torso of a nude woman, mm-hmm. without the head and the arms. It's just the torso. This was actually made as an experiment by my older brother, who's a sculptor. Not a good example of his normal work, but a very nice piece. And he just left it randomly hanging around, so I took it. And it's been in my room for many years now. So actually, that was the inspiration for the Headless Clay Woman. It was just this figure that I had in my room. And turning around from the figure and looking out of my window across the fields in Worcestershire there was this white house that I could always see, but you couldn't ever get to it. It was just an old white house, nothing particularly special about it, but it was the one house that you could see as a house from my window. So late at night in those days, when the world was quiet and there was no internet and TV had stopped, I used to sit at my window sometimes and just look out and I'd see this house, and I made the connection between the figurine and the house, and took the woman up out of the ground to walk around the house and inhabit it. That was where that idea came from.
Okay, so I was right in a way, because again, you wrote in the history about your brother, and that there were many of his sculptures, figurines in the house.
Yeah.
And at that point, I thought, yes, maybe the headless clay woman is kind of a sculpture from your brother, and maybe in a way this is a key to some of the earlier Streets lyrics. Sometimes it's like you're walking around in such a world of artifacts. Okay. And that's interesting. You wrote also in the history that you were in the beginning, you made everything about the design of the releases by yourself, the covers, the sleeves, the band pictures. How did this self-made evolve over the years till now?
Well, we pretty much stayed doing that the entire time. The only time we departed from doing the cover work ourselves was with the Listen for the Rag and Bone Man, when we decided to use some photographs by a photographer called Jerome Sevret, French guy, which worked very well with the sound of the album, we thought. And then after that, with Hunter Not the Hunter, we asked Ulrich Moller, the Danish artist, if we could use one of his paintings. Other than that, it's always been our own creations and our own artwork.
So you're surrounded by different kinds of arts from the beginning, it seems.
Yeah. Mm. Yes, we often say in interviews, but there's something Justin pointed out a few years ago, that Justin and I in particular, we're like artists that make music rather than musicians that make art.